There have been numerous books written about the Cuban Missile Crisis, both by historians and those who had firsthand knowledge of the people and events that took place. One perspective that hasn't gotten much attention is that of the U-2 pilots who were performing top-secret surveillance flights of Cuba. Michael Togas and Casey Sherman, the authors of The Finest Hours, have teamed up once again to tell the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the U-2 pilots who were on the front lines. The book is Above and Beyond, John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission. Michael Togas, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What got you interested in writing a book about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
A little known aspect of the crisis pulled me right in, and that was the shoot down of Major Rudy Anderson over the island of Cuba during the missile crisis. I never knew there was a combat casualty during this whole 13 days in October. And I figured, well, if I don't know that, other people don't know it. And then through the research, we uncovered four other lesser-known incidents.
So how you and Casey Sherman worked on this together. Mm-hmm. Do you each have different chapters? How did that work?
It worked well. We basically split the book. I wrote the first chapter, and then Casey wrote the first half of the book after that, and then I wrote most of the second half of the book. So we weren't stepping on each other's toes. So in the first half of the book, we're following these pilots, we're following Kennedy into power, and the second half is the 13 days of the crisis. So I primarily focused on that.
So why did the U.S. develop the U-2 spy plane, and what were the goals of this top-secret program?
Well, it was quite a plane. I like to call it a glider on steroids. You know, it had a jet engine, but yet basically it was a lightweight glider. So its primary purpose was to be so high up, 13 miles above the earth, higher than any other aircraft, that the enemy couldn't see it or shoot it down. And it worked very well until we got a rude awakening with the shoot down of Gary Powers. And most people are aware of that one. That happened in 1960 over Russia. So, but the purpose of the spy plane was to be lightweight enough to get so high and just carry cameras. No bombs, no guns, no nothing else. Just one pilot and a tiny cockpit. And kind of a simple aircraft at that. Jerry McElmore, one of the U-2 pilots who flew over Cuba, said it was a little bit like flying a glider, but a little bit like flying a fighter jet. But he said, of all the aircraft I've ever flown, the U-2 was the most difficult. Hmm. And he said that's why we called it the Dragon Lady, because we never knew what to expect.
Yeah. So how was it different than a fighter jet?
Well, it didn't go at these, you know, incredibly fast speeds. And its purpose was to climb to that 13 miles above the earth and then cruise at about 100 miles per hour. So, you know, it didn't have a maneuverability to speak of. Again, didn't have bombs. It was up there, and you would turn the cameras on if you had good weather. The cameras could not pierce cloud cover. And of course, it was taking old-fashioned film, mm-hmm. So it would take about a mile of film per mission, and each one of those images had to be examined very closely.
President Eisenhower wanted the U-2 program to be separate from the military. Why and how was that accomplished?
Yeah, the was built under complete secrecy, so that was the primary reason. So the CIA was in charge of it, and they actually did a fantastic job from concept to finish. It was under 2 years that this thing was put together and operational, and the flights began. The very first flight originated out of the UK and headed towards Russia. And then we started flying them from other bases like Turkey. And we were gaining all sorts of great intelligence information about the Russians from these until the Gary Powers incident. Mm. Because we learned the Russian MiGs, their jet fighters, couldn't reach the plane, but their surface-to-air missiles with few improvements could.
Yeah. So talk about what it's like for a pilot flying. You know, you're going up, as you said, 13 miles.
Yes.
The pressure, and you had to have special suits.
Yeah, if the cabin was pressurized, and picture a tiny little cabin that, you know, you're cramped in. If that were to lose air pressure, which it did every now and then, not in combat or anything like that, but sometimes it did, if you didn't have on a pressure suit, you would die within seconds. Your blood would really boil. And so I found out that the pressure suits were made in Worcester, Mass, of all places, and was top secret. So the U-2 pilots would be flown to Worcester, Mass, and they weren't told where they're going, marched into a bra factory that manufactured bras, and taken to the basement, gone through two secret doors, go to one room that just had one hanging light bulb, and there'd be a tailor in there saying, take off every stitch of your clothes, get up on this block, we're going to measure you. And the pilot said it was amazing. We'd go back the next day, and the pressure suit would fit perfectly.
Yeah,
it was like a wetsuit, so yeah. You know, you'd shimmy into it. But that would save their lives if they used lost cabin pressure.
So how did they recruit the pilots to fly these planes?
They would approach Air Force pilots primarily and say, you could make a lot more money doing this, and you'll be segueing over to the CIA. And many were attracted by that because of the monetary incentive, but many washed out. A lot because you were flying these for maybe 8 hours at a time, alone, unarmed, so you were vulnerable. And I think the claustrophobia aspect would have gotten me hearing about the way the pilots had to be up there for so long under complete silence.
Mm.
Others, like, again, one of the pilots I worked with said it could be quite beautiful,
yeah,
the curvature of the earth.
Yeah, it seems like peaceful.
Yeah. Peaceful,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, so how much did the pilots know about the missions that they were flying?
Oftentimes they didn't know exactly what they were photographing, and they couldn't see the photos, by the way. It wasn't like they had a video camera or anything. They just knew when, at what point they were over a target to turn the cameras on. So even in the Cuban Missile Crisis, they didn't know they were photographing nuclear missiles. They suspected something big was happening because they were launched, in bunches.
Hmm. So the book focuses on two U-2 pilots, Rudy Anderson and then Chuck Maltzby.
Yes.
So Rudy, obviously they're not supposed to talk to their wives about what they're doing,
right.
But he used to give hints, right? To,
yes.
Like, not so much what the mission was, but when he'd be, did you pick up my suit? That's a hint he's coming home, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
right.
So tell us, they're from very different backgrounds. Tell us more about each of their early lives.
Well, Rudy Anderson grew up in South Carolina and, you know, always had a dream of flying and went into the Air Force. But ironically, he was a pacifist. He did not want to kill people. So, yes, he had training on fighter jets, but when the Korean War was going on, he volunteered to do surveillance flights. He wasn't in a U-2. He was a different aircraft, but taking photos. Whereas Chuck Maltzby, who grew up in North Carolina, in the same town named, by the way, Greenville, in North Carolina, same thing, only a much more difficult childhood, but got into the Air Force, and he was all for flying fighter jets at combat. And he was actually shot down by the Chinese during the Korean War, held in a 5-foot by 5-foot earthen cave for 2.5 years. And yet when he got out, he went right back to flying again. You know, I would have taken up another profession after that.
Yeah, for sure.
Two very different kind of pilots, because Chuck also became part of the Thunderbirds, and, he was the more flashy of the two, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Now, even though the U-2 planes flew at 75,000 feet, they weren't, as you said, not immune to being shot down. And you start the book with Captain Jerry, and say his last name for me again.
McElmoy,
his flight over Cuba, where he was shot at. He even photographed the contrails of the missile.
Yes.
So that book starts off right with a very tense moment. So tell us a little bit about his experience, what happened there.
So Jerry was one of the early pilots to fly over Cuba. At that time, we knew they had nuclear missiles, and we knew it was very dangerous to fly over Cuba because we also knew they had many surface-to-air missile sites. But nobody had been fired on it yet. That was Khrushchev's orders, do not fire on them. So Jerry was on his last target, which was over Banyes, Cuba, and he had just clicked off the cameras and banked towards home, when in his rearview mirror, he sees a contrail and then a starburst, that's the shrapnel, and then he sees another one come up, and because he's been trained to take photographs, he gets the plane in such a position to get this on film. And then he gets the hell out of there, and he feels very fortunate he hasn't been hit. And when he lands, he goes through his intelligence briefing, and he tells everybody, hey, I was fired at. It's on the film. The film's on its way to Washington. You'll be able to see these contrails and the starbursts. And he also tells Rudy Anderson and the other pilots, they're firing on us. You know, this has reached a new level. And then the next day, Jerry's walking out on the tarmac towards a plane, and he hears McElmoyle, and he turns around, and it's a three-star general who he doesn't know. He's never seen before. He goes, yes, sir. And the general goes, we've examined your film, and you were not fired at. And Jerry goes, I was, sir. I got that on film. I know I did. And the general said, we've not only destroyed your film, we've destroyed your intelligence report. You were not fired on. And Jerry goes, I was, sir. And the general goes, do you understand what I'm telling you? And Jerry finally goes, do what you got to do, but I know I was fired at. And the general left, and everything was destroyed.
So there's two questions. One is, how did he not know? I mean, they have these tracking systems. So it didn't tell him that these surface-to-air missiles were coming. And so that maybe they just didn't turn on, the missiles weren't turned on for tracking?
Yes. Jerry's theory is that they wanted to surprise him by not turning on their whatever you call it. Mm-hmm. I can't remember off the top of the bat, but that electronics that would guide the missile to the plane, and instead he thinks they took a shot anticipating where he would be and were close, but not enough for the shrapnel to hit.
Yeah. And then the other question is, why did this general say you were not fired on? I mean, I guess that's speculation, right? We don't know.
Entirely speculation. I've spent a lot of time with Jerry McElmoyle, who became a brigadier general, by the way, so he's no slouch. He worked his way up. He and I came to the same conclusion that someone, I think someone in the military, he's not so sure, did not want this to get to Kennedy, because if Kennedy knew the planes were being fired at, he probably would have stopped the U-2 overflights, thinking, I don't need another Gary Power incident like Eisenhower had to go through. I don't want to have my pilots be sitting ducks. We know there's missiles there. We've got what we need. Whereas the military, we think, wanted as much information as they could, because when Jerry was shot at, it was just 3 days, 4 days away from the planned invasion of Cuba. Mm. So they would want every bit of intel they could get.
Sure. We're talking with Michael Togas, who co-authored the book Above and Beyond John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Michael Togas, who, along with Casey Sherman, wrote the book Above and Beyond, John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so this U-2 program is top secret, as we've been saying, until this U-2 plane Francis Gary Powers goes down over the Soviet Union and the pilot is captured. So there were procedures set up that if a U-2 plane was attacked and not able to make it back home, there were procedures the pilots were supposed to follow to destroy the plane and themselves. Yes. So what were those procedures and why didn't Powers follow them?
There's a self-destruct switch on the aircraft that would basically blow it up if you knew you were going down in enemy territory. And it would give you maybe 30 seconds to eject. And if the pilot thought you were going down in enemy territory and were to be captured, you were given a poison pin. It used to be a little cyanide pill, but one pilot was in the habit of munching on candy while he was up there, and he almost put that in his mouth, took it out of his pocket. So they switched to a pen that was actually hidden in a silver dollar. And with Gary Powers, when he was hit, the instinct to survive overrode everything. He tried to eject, and he could only get partway out of the aircraft. So he's in this spiraling down, free fall. And that's what the U2s do. If they're crippled and not directly hit, they come down kind of like a leaf falling from a tree. He got half his body out and had to really do some maneuvers to get the rest out. And he was able to parachute safely to the ground, but the Russians captured him. So by then it was too late to pull out his silver dollar and take the poison pen and stick himself.
And so the Soviets were able to find the cameras and even develop the film showing that the pilot had been taking pictures of military bases. So clearly this was a spy mission. So how did the U.S. respond to all of this?
It was very embarrassing for the Eisenhower administration because they used the cover of, oh, these are weather planes to take, you know, readings about meteorological information. And instead, they produced this pilot and, like you said, the film, and they have got the aircraft. Quite embarrassing. And it put a crimp in the U-2 program for a while.
Yeah. So how did this episode further erode U.S.-Soviet relations?
Well, it wasn't good, you know, where Eisenhower's caught telling a lie, and we're going over Russian airspace. We're intruding over their airspace. And, you know, you jump ahead to Kennedy. That was in the back of his mind. He did not want the CIA involved with the missions over Cuba. He wanted to switch it to the Air Force, and he did. He had only Air Force pilots doing it so that he could say, well, they were on missions and strayed over Cuba, but they were on missions, you know, outside of your airspace, of the Caribbean or whatever. He had been burned. He felt he had been burned by the CIA during the Bay of Pigs.
So how did Powers' capture impact the other U-2 pilots?
They knew him. So, you know, again, my main contact of Jerry McElmore, the last living U-2 pilot who flew over Cuba, they all knew Gary Powers, and some had the opinion, yeah, he should have killed himself. Others said, no way, you've got to eject if you can. So there was a mix of opinions, as there was in the U.S. and in Congress as well. Mm. He got grilled. I've studied Powers, and he wrote an autobiography. I kind of came down on his side. Stuff's happening awful fast up there, and you just want to eject. Yeah.
So what happened to him? The U.S. was able to secure his release, right?
Yeah, there was a trade of a spy for him. And ironically, so Gary Powers had to defend himself back in the country, which he did fairly successfully. And the most ironic thing of all is Gary Powers died in a helicopter doing the traffic report for a radio station over Los Angeles.
Wow.
It's just, you know, he survives being shot down 13 miles up in a U-2.
Wow.
Only, and what happened was he ran out of gas.
So in 1960, John F. Kennedy is elected president, and he inherits this clandestine program started under the Eisenhower administration to overthrow Fidel Castro, the president of Cuba. So what was the perceived threat from Cuba at this time?
Just to have a communist country right at our doorstep, whereas before we had our puppet in there, Batista, terrible dictator. And, you know, you can almost understand why Castro came to power and came to power so easily. But we wanted him out. He had nationalized many of the companies that were U.S. companies working in Cuba. He just took them over and said, now they're Cuban. And They wanted him out, and they wanted him out using any method they could. They had a committee headed by Bobby Kennedy called the Mongoose Committee, which was trying to come up with ways to get him assassinated. And through various means, we decided we'll back the Cubans who agree with the U.S. and want to overthrow Castro, what turned out to be the Bay of Pigs landing.
Right. So, yeah, a few months later after that, JFK meets with Soviet Premier Khrushchev. Talk about that meeting.
It was a tough one for Kennedy because Khrushchev is railing away, and rightfully so. Khrushchev is, you know, accusing the U.S. of, you know, backing this Bay of Pigs failed invasion. And I think Khrushchev might have come away with the feeling of Kennedy as someone that can be handled, if you will, might not be as strong as Eisenhower was. So that seems to be the main takeaway. And in JFK's defense, he's listening to Khrushchev just ramble on and berate him. And what are you going to do with a person like that? You're just going to get through the meeting and go, this guy's a little off center. But I later learned that Khrushchev was not off center and was not this mercurial character that I thought he was.
Yeah. So let's go back to Chuck Mosby for a
bit.
Let's talk about his trip where he loses sight of where he is and he accidentally gets into Soviet airspace. Talk about that trip.
Chuck Maltzby has been assigned to Alaska in his U-2, and he's told, fly over the North Pole and collect radioactive samples, and it's our way to monitor what the Russians were doing with their nuclear testing. The problem was his mission occurred on what is now known as Black Saturday, the worst day of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the day we come closest to nuclear war. But you wouldn't think Chuck Maltzby would have anything to do with it until halfway into his flight, where he's using celestial navigation because it's at night and there's no radio towers over the frozen, you know, ice of the North Pole. The northern lights, the Aurora Borealis, comes out in full force and he can't pick up any stars. So he loses his way. And he knows he's lost because he's put out a couple radio calls for help and nobody's answering. So he knows he's not over Baxter Island, which is the first base with a radio tower he should be. And he's not sure where he is until he hears Russian music coming over his radio.
Before he hears the music, he hears somebody tells him to go, 15 degrees to the right. Then he hears this 30 degrees to the left with no accent. And he's like, who is that?
He doesn't know who that is, and he has a code word that if he uses, the person he's talking to should answer back with their different code word, and he'll know it's safe. So he doesn't know who's giving him directions, so he gives the code word, and whoever's on the other end of the radio does not respond with the right word back. So now he knows, oh, my God. Yeah. I'm over Russia.
Then when they say it again and he hears the music, he knows
he's in the
trouble.
Music, right.
Yeah,
right.
And he's starting to panic a little bit now.
Particularly because his fuel is just about on empty because he's been lost for so long. So finally he sees which way is east, you know, and his compass isn't affected by the North Pole. But he realizes, oh, my God, I'm going to be out of fuel. There's no way I'm going to make it to Alaska. So I've got
MiGs are on the way.
And the MiGs are on the way. He doesn't know the MiGs are on the way, but they were. There were four MiGs launched. They knew this intruder came into Russian airspace. The Russians are wondering, is it the vanguard of a U.S. attack on Russia? Because it's the height of the missile crisis. So Chuck turns off the power, which loses your cabin pressure, but thank God he's got the pressure suit to keep him alive, and now he's coasting towards the east to safety and getting lower and lower to where the MiGs can get him. Now, on the U.S. side, we know he's in trouble, and we launch our own fighter jets, but interestingly, they don't have the usual air-to-air missiles on them. Because it's the crisis, those missiles have been taken off and replaced with nuclear-tipped air-to-air missiles. And these guys actually have the authority to use them if they need to, which is scary as hell,
that
the nuclear war could have started all because this one pilot gets lost.
Got lost, yeah. And it's scary, too, because his helmet isn't quite connected to the suit, so it's his windshield's fogging up. It was, like, very dramatic, and you're thinking, oh, my gosh, is he going to make it? And and then he's thinking he's going to just kind of land there in the tundra somewhere, and these two, you know, the cavalry's here, so to speak. They're on each side of him going, hey, you passed the airspace, the runway, which wasn't very big.
Yes, it wasn't his normal runway. It wasn't at an Air Force base. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And it's this gravel strip runway. Really incredible flying skills by Chuck Maltzby.
Yeah.
Yes, he made this mistake, and I know he's been criticized for it because of the, you know, losing his way. But to coast out of there.
And it was like coasting like 10 minutes or something without losing any altitude.
Right.
That was amazing.
That was amazing. And probably saved his life.
Yeah. And then when he's going to land and he can't really see where how much space he's got, he knows he needs every bit of that runway. So he asks the radio tower to tell him. He goes, I'll pull up the truck. And the guy pulls the truck up right in the middle of the runway.
Yeah, right. He wanted him to pull the truck up at the very beginning so Chuck would know, okay, this is the beginning of this rough gravel strip. Instead, the guy parks the truck right on the runway. So he's got to make this landing kind of a short stop, if you will.
And then I thought that was interesting. Then there's a lot of action at this little runway because right after he lands and gets out, then they needed to clear the runway for another plane. And that truck just, hooks up to Chuck's U-2 plane and pulls it off the runway.
And they took him into the radar station and they showed him some film that they had. And they said, see these little squiggly lines behind the dot? That's your U-2. They said, those are the four MiGs, and Chuck just went white.
Yeah. Now, President Kennedy isn't too happy when he hears about this.
No. He uses the word, some son of a bitch never gets the message, meaning, doesn't he know this is the height of the crisis? Don't do anything stupid. But again, in Chuck's defense, it wasn't his fault. So, it's just one more incident where a simple mistake could have led to nuclear war, and that's the part that scares me the most.
Yeah. So talk about the relationship between Cuba and the Soviets. What were some of the reasons that they formed an allegiance?
Boy, after the failed Bay of Pigs, having the Russians in there would sure deter the U.S. from any other more vigorous invasion, so they were all for it. Having nuclear missiles in there would put them on an equal footing with the U.S., so they were all for it. It was actually Raul Castro who went to Moscow and negotiated this Russian bases in Cuba. Interestingly, though, the Russians did not allow the Cubans to man the surface-to-air missiles. They were left in the dark on some of the specifics about the nuclear missiles. But Castro was all for it. He thought this was a great way to balance out the U.S. breathing down his neck.
And so thanks to the continued U-2 flights over Cuba, the U.S. then realized the Soviets are installing those surface-to-air missiles that you're talking about. And so even though the missiles are in close proximity to the U.S., some have argued that their presence didn't really shift the balance of power to the Soviets. Did those missiles not increase the threat to America? If they didn't, why did Kennedy feel pressure to remove them?
It's a good question. I think in the big scope of things, they did not significantly change the balance of power. They did change the time frame that a missile could reach the U.S. It would be a little quicker. But Kennedy knew this was as much a political issue as it was military. He said to Bobby, if I don't get those missiles out of there, I'll be impeached, that nobody in the U.S. is going to stand for missiles on our doorstep, even though we had missiles on the Russians' doorstep.
Right.
I thought that was kind of interesting. So, so both the fact that they could reach the U.S. in, such a short period of time, and the political ramifications of doing nothing. Right. That was never an option.
Yeah. So President Kennedy addresses the nation and informs them of the Soviet missiles in Cuba and a naval blockade to prevent more missiles from coming into Cuba. Americans now realize nuclear war is a possibility. So how did the American public respond?
I gave a presentation on this just 2 weeks ago, and a woman in the audience said, I lived down south. She was actually in Texas at the time. She said, my dad, the next morning, was digging in the backyard to build us a shelter. She said that's how fearful it was. There wasn't widespread panic or anything, but there was a little bit of what preparations we might do for a hurricane, for example, flashlights and things like that. But most people, were ill-equipped. We didn't have enough, fallout shelters for everybody. That's for sure.
Yeah, you and I were both around at that time, and kids. I remember my dad reading magazines of the bomb shelters, and everybody was talking about that. And at school, where we have those, exercises where we get under the desk,
right.
Like that's going to save us. I mean, I'm thinking, why did we do that? What was the point of that? I think it just made us more afraid.
It did. And you know what? We should have been even more afraid because in Above and Beyond, I identify four different times we were on the verge of nuclear war that I never knew about. And I'm a history buff.
Yeah.
Scary as hell.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Michael Togas, who, along with Casey Sherman, have authored Above and Beyond, John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to chime in, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So before the break, you talked about identifying four different times where we were really on the brink of nuclear war. Do you think most people remember the Cuban Missile Crisis,
right.
But do you think people realize that we were that close?
No, not the specifics.
Yeah. Mm. So remind people what those specifics are.
Well, the first was what we discussed with Chuck Maltzby, where he, inadvertently enters Russian airspace, and that almost causes a nuclear exchange. Another one that few people know about is the Russian sub, B-59. We had told the Russians, if we locate one of your subs, we're going to drop practice depth charges to force them to the surface because you're approaching the quarantine line. Well, I don't think that message got to the commanders of the sub. And if it did, he wasn't sure that these were practice depth charges because we didn't just drop three or four like we said we were going to. We dropped 20. Mm. And they'd been down there for hours just being, as they said, the Russians said, it was like being in a steel drum being banged around. And so the commander thinks, well, this must be World War III up top. And he says to his crew, we're all going to die, but they're going to die too. Put the special torpedo in tube number 3. And they do. Mm. And if it wasn't for another person of equal rank on that sub, just by coincidence, to talk him down, they would have launched it, and it would have just wiped out our aircraft carrier and the fleet around it, and that would have begun World War III.
Scary. Yeah. Let's talk to Roz, who's calling from Eastham. Hi, Roz.
Hi. So I have been listening for quite some time to this show today I'm talking about, and I haven't heard anything that I particularly want to comment about, because I haven't heard it yet, but I would like to offer a point of view, if that's okay.
Yeah, oh, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Okay, so in terms of the Bay of Pigs, my understanding is that the Bay of Pigs was orchestrated by the Dulles brothers and Eisenhower, and they were convinced that the Cuban people would welcome the 1,400 expatriates who were going to invade Cuba and save them from Castro. And they were convinced that the Cuban people were going to do that. However, in less than 3 days, the Cuban people had won that war, and 1,200 of the 1,400 expatriates were prisoners of Cuba because the people were behind Castro. 20 months later, Castro gave those 1,200 prisoners back to the United States in exchange for money for baby food.
Hmm. Yeah, well, so Michael's nodding his head, so you're agreeing with what she's saying?
Yes, and one of the reasons the invasion failed, it would have failed anyways, but Kennedy got cold feet, and he kind of got this thrust upon them. Later realizes he didn't ask nearly enough questions, didn't get nearly enough different opinions on it, and he pulled back a lot of the air support for the invasion. So that made their failure complete. And like you said, it was over in no time at all. It was just a total fiasco.
Yeah, Roz.
And Kennedy was new to the office.
Exactly.
He just took what his predecessors had planned. But what he learned from it was that what his predecessors said was that the Cuban people were going to despise Castro and welcome the invaders was 100% wrong.
Right.
So when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, now again, this is my understanding from my research, when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, Kennedy, you know, through whatever channels, met with and spoke with Castro and the Castro regime to find out why were these missiles there. And it was, like you said, that Castro felt, we don't want any more Bay of Pigs, you know, and if this is going to deter you from doing that, fine. And so Kennedy understood and made an agreement with the Castro regime that there would be no more attacks of that nature, and therefore you could take down the missiles because Kennedy was not about to go in and do another invasion. And so there was an agreement there. And you may know that, of course, had the Kennedys lived, there was a huge reconciliation going on. And Ethel Kennedy, you know, was friends with Castro and yada, yada, yada. So there
right.
was a whole big history there.
Yeah. The agreement part is true, but that it was not made with Castro. We didn't really communicate with Castro. Everything was through Khrushchev. And the agreement was very simple. We will not invade Cuba. We will remove our missiles from Turkey, but you have to keep that private. We don't want the public to know about that. You, in turn, have to remove all your missiles and do so immediately under the guidance of the United Nations. And that's what solved it. But it was the incidents on Black Friday that forced Khrushchev and Kennedy to quickly come to a solution, because if they didn't, I think within 24 hours, we would have been at World War III. We're that close.
Yeah, Roz, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Roz knows her history, huh?
Yes, she sure does.
So getting back to President Kennedy and Khrushchev, these, you know, they were level-headed men. I mean, President mm-hmm. Kennedy was getting a lot of advice on both sides. We need to attack. No,
right.
we shouldn't. I mean, he was really hearing lots of different opinions about what we should do. And he listened.
Yeah, he did. You know, he even allowed Curtis LeMay to be borderline insubordinate. LeMay was the head of the Air Force, the head of Strategic Air Command. And LeMay, a couple times LeMay said things like, "Mr. President, you're looking very weak on this. We need to go in and hit them immediately. We can't wait any longer." And Kennedy would say, "Well, don't you think the Russians, once we kill a bunch of Russians in Cuba, we'll take over West Berlin?" And LeMay would go, "No, no way." And then at another exchange, LeMay goes, "Mr. President, you're in a really bad fix." And Kennedy goes, "What did you say?" And LeMay goes, "You're in a bad fix." And Kennedy goes, "Well, you're in it with me." So he almost diffuses it with tension. But amazingly, he doesn't expel him from the meeting. He right. wants this difference of opinion,
yeah.
even though LeMay, I call LeMay bombs away LeMay, never never saw a target he didn't want to bomb.
Right. Well, we know that Khrushchev and Kennedy are both very worried about losing control over the situation. And there were a number of incidents, as we were talking about, that could happen. But both
right.
of them used the same language about losing
yes.
control.
Yes, especially when I discussed this with Sergei Khrushchev, I said, "Wow, the way you're describing what your father felt is the way Jack Kennedy described it to Bobby."
Yeah. And what were the words they used?
That my biggest fear is that some incident, some miscommunication, somebody at a lower level does something that causes this thing to spin out of control. And before you know it, we've entered an abyss that we can't back away from.
All right, you're going to read a little section for us about...
So, yeah, I'll give a little background on this section. So, on Black Saturday, Major Rudy Anderson has volunteered for a flight over Cuba. And this is one of those events that almost triggers nuclear war. So, while he's flying over Cuba, the Russians, of course, have him on radar. They know he's up there. And I'm going to read from the book on that part. "The Russians at the Banyas SAM site, surface-to-air missile site, had their missiles trained on Target 33. That's Rudy. They were ready to fire, worried that if the orders did not come soon, the spy plane would, quote, be out of the hitting zone. Then over the radio came the command, Target 33 is to be destroyed. At 11:19 a.m., Rudy Anderson must have felt a terrible jolt, much the same way Gary Powers had. One of the SAMs exploded close to Rudy's aircraft, but it was not a direct hit, which would have blown the plane into 100 pieces. Instead, shrapnel from the SAM killed the Dragon Lady and Rudy. The Dragon Lady is the nickname of the U-2. We will never know for sure what happened in the final seconds. Did the plane's missile detection device turn red? Did he have time to make a series of turns to try and elude the oncoming missile? Did he feel the thump of the shrapnel hitting the plane and see the orange glow of the bursting SAM as Gary Powers had? Or did he black out as the shrapnel came through the plane and into his body? When small pieces of shrapnel pierced the upper part of his flight suit, decompression would have followed. He might have remained conscious for a few seconds until he passed out from loss of oxygen or as his blood boiled as the pressure suit deflated. If he was conscious for a few seconds, he apparently had no time or was simply unable to activate the destruct switch and then eject from the aircraft. If he did have 3 or 4 seconds before blacking out, Anderson probably struggled to control the crippled plane, and the last thing he saw before dying was likely the blue sky spinning above him.
Now, to say that his wife, Jane, was distraught is understatement, and she was very upset that President Kennedy did not attend the funeral.
Yes, and, you know, the way the Air Force did things back then was pretty cold because it wasn't long after Rudy was killed that she's asked to pack up and leave the airbase with her children. The family's told us Jane was never the same.
Yeah. And what about the other U-2 pilots? They took this death pretty hard as well. There was anger there with them as well.
They did, and Jerry McElmoyle in particular, because he had been fired at, and now Rudy, who went down at the exact same place where Jerry was fired at, Banyas, Cuba. But interestingly, Jerry said all of us were willing to fly the next day, even though we knew that we were sitting ducks. And in Kennedy's defense, you know, you mentioned how Jane Anderson wished Kennedy was at the funeral. Kennedy did fly all the way down to Homestead Air Force Base after the crisis was over and personally thank the U-2 pilots. And Jerry was selected to give Kennedy a little tour of the aircraft. And Kennedy waved off the entourage, and it was just Jerry, one other pilot, and Kennedy for half an hour talking. And Kennedy said, "What does your wife know about this?" And Jerry said, "Nothing, sir. It's all classified." And Kennedy goes, "You could tell her everything now."
Yeah. And then
you
the other pilot said, "You can tell too." Yeah,
yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
It's hard to read about the Cuban Missile Crisis and not think about the current situation between the U.S. and North Korea. Now, we're not at the brink of war. We are at a delicate moment when relations could deteriorate quickly. So what does history show us about this incident that the current administration might learn?
I enjoyed analyzing the steps Kennedy took to reach the decisions on how to resolve this. The first one was picking his team of advisors. He called them the XCOM, Executive Committee. And it wasn't just military people and the usual LBJ and, you know, Bobby Kennedy. He had people in for their minds. For example, Secretary of the Treasury, people who retired, former ambassadors to Moscow. And then he'd bring in people not to sit on the committee, but for a one-day meeting who had expertise, such as the photographic interpreters who analyzed the U-2 film. So I was very impressed by that. And they weren't all Democrats. Some had Republican ties. So he got this broad range of advice. And he would ask them, put yourself in the adversary's shoes. And they brainstormed on that. He would say things like, with whatever your option you're coming up with and recommending to me, I don't want you to give it to me until you take this evening to think about all the consequences that will follow from that option. And then the one I liked the best was his goal was fixed, which was the missiles have to go. He said that on the very first day, but the plan to do it kept changing. And I think that's the way to go about a decision. New information's coming in. Be flexible, so much so that Kennedy actually reversed himself when the U-2 was shot down with Rudy Anderson. He had said, if they shoot down a U-2, we will immediately attack and take out that SAM site and probably some of the others. And yet when it happened, he said, hold off. And Curtis LeMay was furious. He called Kennedy a chicken. He said he chickened out again. But Kennedy knew he had this brief window, just maybe 12 hours left, and he told Bobby, go over to the Soviet ambassador and give him, he never used the word ultimatum, but that's essentially what it was, that here's the deal. If this doesn't happen, it looks like we're going to take action on Monday.
So talk about your research. You mentioned you spent a lot of time with Jerry.
Yes.
Did it take a long time to uncover all of this information? What was your research like?
You know, thank God for the internet. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a high-tech person, but so many of the CIA documents have been declassified, and you can find them on the internet. George Washington University has a bunch of them. Thank God that Chuck Maltzby wrote a little self-published autobiography, and so we learn about what happened when he strayed into Russian airspace. And then the family members of these U-2 pilots, they were all essential, and Sergei Khrushchev. So trying to get to the people who were the closest to it, Steve Heiser, the one who found the missiles originally, he was the pilot who found them. He had passed away, but his son knew quite a bit, and his son said, you know, my dad gave an interview just 2 days after he found the missiles, and I'll send you that. I was
wow.
like, perfect. and then, again, Jerry McElmoy was by far the best resource. He was the pilot that flew over Cuba, was shot at, and his mind is as sharp as ever.
Yeah, I was gonna, that's where we started in the book. That was the first chapter. And that still kind of is the question, right? Because it was, they said, you weren't shot at. They destroyed that information.
Right.
But when Jerry becomes a general, doesn't he ask if that information is still around?
Yes, he had briefed Ronald Reagan on how to use the nuclear football. And when that briefing was done, he had a conversation with the CIA, and they liked Jerry, and they said, hey, if there's anything we can ever do for you, Jerry goes, actually, there is. Can you find the photo interpreter who looked at my film from October 25th, 1962? And a week later, that photo analysis called him and said, oh, yeah, there were two starbursts on your film, sir.
So he got his answer.
He got his answer,
but
yes.
Again, we speculate as to why they
right.
said that you weren't shot at, but we
right.
don't really know the answer. All right, we'll have more information about Above and Beyond, John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission by Casey Sherman and Michael Tokas at our website, capeandislands.org. You'll be at the Chatham Library the 31st at 7 p.m., right?
Yep, might be even earlier. You can look on my website as well, michaeltokas.com.
And we will put a link
yes.
with all your book signings and more information about the book. Michael Tokas, always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.